This is Theatre Voice, and my name is Alex Sears. Our guest for this session is the award-winning playwright Jo Penhall. Amazing as it seems, it's already more than 10 years since Penhall first burst onto the British theatre scene in 1994, when the Royal Court's Stephen Daldry programmed his play Some Voices as the curtain raiser to his first season of New Writers, a season that included Sarah Kane's now legendary debut, Blasted. Having had a good response to this tale of two brothers, one of whom is a schizophrenic, Penhall went on to write a series of plays which combine social realism. After all, he once worked as a reporter on a local paper in West London, and echoes of a much more literary sensibility. There's something definitely a bit mythic about the relationships between some of his characters, such as the two brothers Ray and Pete in Some Voices. Penhall's other plays include Pale Horse, Love and Understanding, and, most recently, Dumb Show at the Royal Court. In all of them there beats a strong sense of moral conviction, which doesn't mean that Penhall is in any way preachy, simply that he's not afraid to stage debates about the conflict between right and wrong. And the really wonderful thing is that he never forgets to entertain us while he's doing it. In his most accomplished work, Blue Orange, which was first put on at the National Theatre in April 2000, he wrestles with difficult questions about race, madness, and professional rivalry at a London psychiatric hospital. This award-winning play is now being revived, this time directed by Kathy Burke, no less, at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield, where it runs until the 26th of February. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Jo Penhall. Could you start by saying something about this new production of Blue Orange at Sheffield Theatres?
Well, it's the first major revival that there's been of Blue Orange in this country, which is exciting. It's in a much bigger theatre than it's ever been in before. The Sheffield Crucible is about twice the size of the Duchess in the West End, where it was for a year. And the Duchess is twice the size of the National's Cottesloe, where it originated. So, if nothing else, it'll be a fascinating experiment to see how it goes down in a big house. I've got to say, it's an exceptional cast. One thing that's exciting about doing this play again and again is discovering great actors that I haven't worked with before. And Roger Lloyd-Pack, Sean McKenzie, and Jimmy Akinbola are three really exciting actors. Who are every bit as good as the other two casts that have done it. So to me, that's the major excitement. And Kathy is a really exciting director. And again, very different to all the directors that have done it before. And, you know, on her own merits, a great director. So it's, to me, it's a bit like starting all over again. It's a bit like the premiere, you know. I'm very excited about it. I've been up there in rehearsals. They seem to be doing a great job. I'm really looking forward to it.
Have you rewritten any of the play?
Not for this production, no. I mean, when it went into the West End, I made a few trims, and when it was on in America, I changed a couple of words. But by now, no, I haven't rewritten anything. It's been pretty well worked out.
Let's talk a little about the situation of the play. It's set in a London psychiatric hospital, and it's got three characters: Christopher, the black patient, Bruce, the doctor looking after him, and Robert, I suppose, the head of the unit.
Can you
say a bit about how the situation develops?
Well, the story of the play is that this patient has turned up in this hospital claiming to be the son of a infamous deposed African dictator. And his story is initially wildly implausible, as the stories of most mental patients are, and then progressively more and more plausible. And they find themselves in the awkward position, these two doctors, of not knowing whether to discharge him on the grounds that he's better and this story could be absolutely true, you know. He's obviously got African ancestry and family, or whether to keep him in on the grounds that he has got a fixed belief, and obviously a very bizarre delusion, which could cause him some trouble. So it's really an argument between these two doctors, and the younger doctor wants to keep him in and treat him further, and the older doctor wants to release him to the community, and the younger doctor thinks the older doctor has an agenda, which is to essentially toe the government line of releasing as many patients as possible and freeing up beds. And the older doctor thinks that the younger doctor is incompetent and has given him the wrong diagnosis and is negligent and unorthodox. And it becomes a battle of wills, really. And it, by the end of the play, one of them has been driven out of the medical profession. And Christopher has... Well, I won't say what happens at the end, but...
I suppose the clever thing is that you make the diagnosis a borderline personality disorder, which means that the audience is immediately guessing whether he is suffering from a mental disease, distress, dysfunction. And gradually, obviously, through the play, you reveal that he is. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that comes from... I mean, that's a kind of a found piece of juicy information, really. I didn't sort of concoct it to be clever. I discovered that this condition, which is termed borderline personality disorder, is a kind of catch-all for a lot of mental illnesses, you know. And as they explain in the play, you know, you can have a borderline personality disorder with depression or with alcoholism or with narcissism. At the end of the day, it means that you behave very crazily. And a lot of those symptoms and types of behavior are very common to other forms of mental illness, you know, schizophrenia, for example. Schizophrenics get depressed, schizophrenics medicate themselves with alcohol, schizophrenics experience narcissism and nihilism and self-destructive tendencies. So they're very similar diagnoses. It's just that schizophrenia is like cancer in the sense that it's, you never get rid of it, it's terminal, it's got terrible stigma attached to it. It scares people, and doctors are very loath to diagnose it. It's really quite a wild illness. A borderline personality disorder is something that's reasonably manageable. A lot more people than you realize have got borderline personality disorders. You know, very often people with addiction problems have got those addiction problems because they're managing sort of personality disorders with drugs and alcohol. So it struck me as being initially a very difficult thing to determine whether somebody has got the one illness or the other illness. But I've got to be honest, and also that, you know, say that the definition of a borderline personality disorder is somebody who is on the border between neurotic and psychotic, which always struck me as quite frankly hilarious. To be on the border between neurotic and psychotic has got to be the most precarious position you could possibly be. To be neurotic is one thing, to be psychotic is the other, but to sort of straddle both in this kind of dreadful no man's land of acceptability just strikes me as disastrous, and sort of in a horribly morbid way, rather funny. So I kind of seized on that, really. And apart from anything else, you know, this is, you know, a lot of people seem to be on the border between neurotic and psychotic. A lot of people that I seem to meet. So it struck me as relatively universal.
Christopher's also, as I said before, a black patient. How important is the racial aspect of the play?
Well, to me, the whole play is about cultural specificity. It's about cultural assumptions. And it's about the assumption that black people or brown people or, you know, yellow people or, you know... people from cultures that we aren't necessarily that familiar with have wildly different forms of behaviour and wildly different assumptions about life and wildly different sort of principles. And so Robert, as this educated, white, middle-aged, Anglo-Saxon academic, has all these assumptions about Christopher's behaviour, and some of his behaviour is assumed to be quite simply mad behaviour, and some of it is assumed to be culturally specific. And I'm just fascinated by that, because I'm somebody that's sort of grown up in various different parts of the world and has been an outsider in a number of different societies, and particularly living in England, you become very aware. It's changing now; it literally changes by the decade. But you become very aware that there is a kind of Middle English way of looking at the world, and anybody else, whether they be African or Jamaican or Pakistani or Indian, or indeed, you know, a Kiwi, they're kind of examined and seen as a kind of exhibit, you know. And you know, Robert's got this line which he takes to be a great revelation, which is that the man in the corner shop, you know, the Hindi man in the corner shop probably doesn't say please and thank you because he doesn't have it in his culture. And I've heard people say that, and I even read an article in the paper by some eminent academic stating that in defense of Prince Philip and his ridiculous gaffes. And I just thought, well, this is woeful that, you know, at the turn of the 21st century, we still have these assumptions, you know, that Indian people don't know how to say please and thank you. It's alien to their culture, you know. African people tend to have boogly eyes and yell a lot. It's part of their culture, you know. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And so Robert, you know, finds himself in this fascinating but ultimately ridiculous position of suggesting that the reason why Christopher is endlessly paranoid and jumpy and antic is because, you know, that's just what you do where he comes from.
Can you say something about each of the characters in turn?
Well, Robert is a fascinating character to me because he embodies a paradox, really, which is that he is ultimately a very good doctor and a very smart guy, and the research that he's doing to discover the cultural element in people's behaviour is fascinating research, and it is indeed what people are researching now. You know, is there a cultural element in the behaviour of people of the Jamaican community, you know, which makes them more prone to being arrested, you know. There are so many black patients in hospitals now, you know, 12 times more than white patients with diagnosis of mental illness. Is it to do with the way that we're diagnosing them? Is it to do with our attitude towards their behavior? Are we just being ethnocentric, you know? So his research and his notions are fascinating and brilliant, and they're right. But the fascinating thing about it also is that he's reached the age and the stage in his career where he's kind of torn between towing the government line and the line fed to him by the hospital administrators, which is expedience, expedience, expedience. Throw out the patients into the community, free up beds, throw medication at them, onto the next one. He's torn between that and becoming this fascinating, wonderful, saintly R.D. Lang type figure who does this extraordinary research and saves the world. And it strikes me as a kind of eternal dilemma that we have as human beings, which is that we can't decide between the sophisticated, brilliant, ideal way to behave and way to think and the ideal principles that we wish we could have, and expediency, you know, just working for the man, doing the thing that will get you your paycheck and that will, you know, get you good brownie points. Towing the government line.
And what about Bruce, his sort of younger colleague?
Bruce is very young and idealistic and naive, and he calls a spade, so to speak. And he is very sure that Christopher is mentally ill, and that this is something terrible will happen if he's released. He has no kind of internal stratagem for phrasing his arguments. He has no way of phrasing his arguments and his sentiments in a sort of palatable way for Robert. And Robert is a powerful, sophisticated, educated establishment figure, and he's the essence of charm, and he knows how to spin a good line. Bruce has got no idea how to spin a good line. He's endlessly clumsy and gauche and offends everybody else in the play. Robert strikes me as a wonderful propagandist and spokesman, and to that extent, I find it interestingly political in that the argument at the moment, and certainly for the last 10 or 15 years, has been sort of the argument between spin and sophisticated propaganda and the truth. And often the truth is expressed in a gauche way. I mean, famously, you know, the Labour Party in prior to the Blair era were sort of monosyllabic and gauche and not especially sprightly linguistically, you know. Kinnock was not a great salesman. And then Blair came in and he was a silver-tongued goodie who became a silver-tongued baddie. And that's what Robert is, you know. And Bruce is this kind of rather forlorn Kinnock-type figure who just calls the truth, calls it as he sees it, and just puts his foot in his mouth time and time again, you know. And what he says is used and manipulated and spun to make him, you know, to undermine his case.
And caught in the middle between these two rivals is Christopher, of course.
Yeah, and Christopher is kind of completely disenfranchised and doesn't have a voice to all intents and purposes. And when he does speak, they don't really understand him. And so these two sort of merrily spin their arguments and saber-rattle, knowing that inevitably one of them will win. But it's never really on the agenda that Christopher will win. It's never really a part of the evening's entertainment that Christopher will prove to sort of be the dominant male there. It's understood that the two educated white middle class guys, one of them must be right, you know, and they have that assumption. They have that kind of sense that Christopher is a prize to be argued over. He's a kind of political football. So it's about the disenfranchised getting together with the extremely popular establishment figures that run the world and finding that they don't really have a voice, you know.
Obviously you feel passionately about the condition of mental patients. This is the second play in which you've dealt with that theme. How did it come about originally? Why did you write it?
It was purely because I had a friend who was schizophrenic, and he went through kind of hell dealing with it. And I just felt terribly, terribly sorry for him, and thought he was an extraordinary guy, you know. And so I just took an interest in it when it came up. And you know, it comes up a lot in London. You know, a lot of the people you see around on the street. I'm suffering from mental illness of some sort, you know. And I was a journalist for a little while, and there was a lot of stories that I was doing that were to do with the care and the community legislation. And I was just sort of putting two and two together, really, and realising that the people that I saw sort of slumped in a doorway were actually not that many steps removed from this friend of mine who was a brilliant guy. It wasn't, you know, homelessness, etc., 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 alcoholism, whatever. Are not lifestyle choices, you know. They usually start somewhere with some organic illness, probably. And, you know, society is unconsciously has these assumptions and makes these judgments of people, which is that something murky and mysterious has gone wrong. And the big revelation to me was that nothing murky and mysterious has gone wrong. You know, generally what's happened is somebody's been trying to manage a terrible mental illness, you know. That's probably 70% of the homeless population. The other 30% are probably victims of abuse. There's not too many people that did it because they read Jack Kerouac's On the Road and decided it was a groovy lifestyle choice, you know.
The play typically ends quite ambiguously, and there's a certain amount of ambiguity in each of the characters. Is that right?
Yeah, I think ambiguity is kind of my default position. And I love the fact that the intriguing thing about Robert is that he appropriates essentially liberal notions, permissive 60s hippie notions. You know, Ardy Lang was an anti-structuralist, etc., etc., an anti-establishment. But for reactionary means, you know, to win this argument, to fulfill the government guidelines of kicking all the mental patients out because it'll be better for them to send them home, you know. So what he's done is cleverly appropriated a notion from the left to use it for essentially right-wing reasons, which strikes me as something that happens more and more. You know, it's the genius of New Labour was that they kind of appropriated left wing, their good old fashioned left wing notions, but disseminated them in a cloud of kind of spin and propaganda and kind of diluted concessions. And I think that that's an interesting part of the human condition. You know, that there's paradox and contradiction in everybody. You know, all the characters are kind of conflicted. Bruce appears to be sort of saintly in his pursuit of the best course for Christopher, but he can't help imploding eventually and having this colossal meltdown and calling Christopher every revolting name under the sun and whining about the blight on his career that Christopher has become, you know. And I find that paradox and that dichotomy is fascinating and human, and it's in all of us. You know, we all let ourselves down with these terrible outbursts. We all have a kind of saintly good agenda, but we're also very aware when we do things of the effect that our altruism is going to have, the way it's going to be perceived. We're all aware of how to manipulate situations to a greater or lesser extent. It doesn't make us bad people, you know.